Sorry about that. Just a little brain burp. Okay. So, anyway, that's where we weren't going with that. The individual brain grows and develops, and it follows a biological course, and it is adapting to specific experience. It's very important that the brain is not just moving along on its genetically programmed course. The brain is responding to specific experience. Some parts of the brain have to have specific input in order to develop. The connections, the synaptic connections, are the result of experience. They are shaped and pruned in response to specific experience. The mind, always hard to put your hands around that and grab it, but the mind is a phenomenon of a functioning brain. If you don't have a functioning brain, you don't have a mind for us to study. And as you think about your own mind and your own thinking, you are using your functioning brain to look at itself, which is an interesting concept. One of my professors in graduate school wrote a book, I'm sorry, an article on autocerebroscopy, which if you take that apart is looking at your own brain, your own mind. It's reflection, introspection. And one of the difficulties that we have in understanding the mind is that we either look at what other people do or we look at what goes on in our own mind. And when other people are doing something, we can only look at what they do. We can't look at what they're thinking. This is a problem, because we can't see in other people's minds. And when we're looking at our own minds and thinking about our own thinking, we're looking at our own thinking, and we're understanding our thinking based on what we think about thinking. And it's very difficult to tell somebody else how we actually think. So it's very difficult for us to communicate the process of thinking to somebody else. And it's difficult for us to observe the process of thinking in another person. So, unlike biology, where we can just look at it and measure it and watch it function, and we don't have to worry about what it means necessarily, when we start thinking about thinking and trying to talk about it, we are inevitably bumping up against the limits of human ability to bridge the gap between two minds. We do a pretty good job of it, of bridging that gap, but we are always bumping up against the fact that only Mr. Spock can do the Vulcan mind meld. Yeah. The Vulcan mind meld? Yeah. Right. What he did was transfer everything from the other being's mind into his own. You know, wetware to wetware. It takes a real interesting firewire connection to do that, but we can't really do it. So we're always limited in how much we can know about what's going on in another person's mind, and we're always limited in what we can explain to other people about what's going on in our minds. But the mind changes as the brain develops. The mind adapts to experience and the experience changes. And as we experience, as we're going through life, experiencing experience, having experiences, we're thinking about it. We're using that experience to construct our understanding of our own experience. Hmm. How do we do that? Well, we're doing that with the brain. And as we know, different parts of the brain are used to process information from different systems, different sensory systems, and for different functions. So we have a cortex that gives us feedback from our motor systems. When we move, we experience that, and we process that in the motor cortex, and we use the motor cortex to produce coordinated movements. We have an auditory cortex. That's where the sound that comes in and gets converted to electrical impulses in our optic, in our auditory nerves goes. And it gets interpreted there. What comes in through our optic nerves comes into the visual cortex and is processed there. We think about visual images in that part of the brain. What they don't do in a picture like this, in an image like this, is draw the connections to the sensory system. But if you think about your ears, you think about the nerves in your fingers, you think about the nerve cells in your inner ears, which tell you whether you're tipping over or not, or falling. You think about your eyes. Those sensory organs are actually extensions of your brain. And if you want something to really creep you out, you think about your eyes. They're a really strange device, your eyes. They are connected to almost every major area of your brain. They are, very simply put, the portion of your brain that is on the outside. They are directly connected to most of the major areas of your brain. So they're a very important organ for organisms that have them. Things happen in our world, and we perceive them through that part of the brain which is in the front of the face. And the information that comes to us is interpreted using many different parts of the brain, and it is fed into different parts of the brain. One way to look at what we're doing, thinking about development, this is what the text is about, this is what people are typically trying to describe when they're talking about cognitive development. One way to think about it, or several ways that are connected, are that we're constructing awareness of the world. Think about what an infant, a newborn, is aware of. What it understands, what parts of experience it can make any sense out of. It is developing that awareness as the sensory system matures. It is developing knowledge. It's not born with any. The hard drive is formatted. But it doesn't have a bunch of files on it. So we have to accumulate the files, the data that goes into that formatted hard drive that we call the brain. We're developing knowledge and understanding of things and actions and states and qualities, in other words, of our experience. We're making sense of that. We're constructing understanding of differences among things. The human brain is very finely tuned to detect differences, not just between experiences, but between ideas, and to relate things and experiences and sensory input to each other. We're constructing knowledge of changes and transformations. We're learning to represent what we understand, and we're organizing. A major feature of our knowledge is that it is organized, and we're constantly organizing and reorganizing our experiences so that we understand our experiences in greater detail. And all of that, apparently, if you're a constructivist particularly, comes about through active participation. We are born into a world that we have evolved to make sense out of. But each of us has to make sense out of it based on our own experience in it. And if we don't have any experience in it, we won't have anything to understand. Most of us get a lot of experience. We're out there grabbing the experience, trying to have as much of it as possible and exploring the world so that we can understand it and constructing knowledge. That's right. No, actually, it doesn't have Microsoft Word. You have to install that. The operating system is different from those applications. That's my point. Because you can chase the metaphor. The metaphor serves quite well, just that we don't have any computer that has anything like the complexity of the brain. It's just not even the biggest supercomputer has the kind of complexity the brain has. But what we can do with that metaphor, with that analogy, is to think about what the operating system is and how sophisticated it is. And in fact, the brain has an operating system, or is an operating system, if you would like. But it's relatively primitive. And the fun thing about looking at development is that the operating system changes as we go through childhood and adolescence. The logic board grows. It changes the way it can put information together. The problem with the computer is that it has an extremely primitive form of operating system, and that's what you've got until you update it. But it would be like updating your operating system by doubling its logical abilities, or at puberty, maybe increasing them 20-fold and adding whole new bunches of operating of programs, applications into it. So it's a fascinating metaphor to chase. And it helps us understand how complex the brain really is. Let me, maybe if I have the right overhead, let me illustrate an operating, oh yeah, okay, here's where we can go with that. The brain is designed to process particular kinds of information. And that information is all coming in through the sensory systems. And as I said, each of those sensory systems feeds into particular parts of the brain where the information is collected and what do we do with that information? We put it with other information that is like it, and we just collect it and we compare it. The kinds of information that we can take in are built into the brain, and we don't really know how many different kinds of information we can take in. For example, we can distinguish all the phonemes that are used in any human language. All of them. So the brain is wired, it has a system for collecting the data from what it's hearing and distinguishing them, as it can tell one sound from another. But as we experience sound, and particularly voices, we focus on particular ones, the sounds that are used by the people we're listening to, and we actually lose, by not developing them, but we lose the ability to distinguish the sounds that we're not using. The cells are there. The cells are there to respond to every sound. But if we don't hear that sound, those cells die. So the only way to assure that you'll be able to hear all of the different sounds in all of the languages is to hear all of the different sounds in all of the languages. So the potential is there, but we lose it, or we shape the brain so that it can do the things we want it to do, which is understand and learn and use the language that the people around us are using. Because that's really important for our survival. We don't need the other 4,500 languages. But we come prepared to learn them all. Let me give you another example. This one I love. This is research done 3 or 4 years ago. Kim. How would you describe the difference? I have a container and I have something that fits in a container relatively tightly. And then I have a something else that fits in the same kind of container, but it's loose and rattles around in there. What words do we use in English to describe the fit? Loose and tight. Snug. Nice. Do you categorize your world according to things, whether things are snug or loose? Some things. It appears that babies come with part of the operating system paying attention to the degree of looseness or fitness, tightness between objects. And it's interesting. If you set up a learning experiment where you have pictures of different objects or even the object, and they differ in many ways, but one of the ways is this, but they differ in color, they differ in shape, the kind of texture they have, size, all of those other ways. And you ask people to categorize them, or you set up a situation where they are getting rewarded if they pick the right characteristic, and one of the characteristics is tight versus loose. When you set that up with infants who are 6 or 8 months old, infants all use that relationship. And they learn it very quickly, and they use it, and they use it spontaneously. And if they're grouping the stimuli, if you set up the experiment so that they are being rewarded for grouping them, or at least grouping them visually, they all use it. If you have Korean college students do the same kind of task, they all use it. It's an important part of their world, and it's right up there with color, texture, shape, size, all of those things. The tightness and looseness is right there. If you do the same experiments, the same tasks, with English-speaking American college students, they don't get it. You don't use that if the other choices are color, shape, texture. And it's not an important feature linguistically for us. But Korean babies learn to label that difference, the degree of looseness and tightness. They learn to label that, and they have a vocabulary for it. And they learn it in the second year. They learn those words. They're important words. And we learn snug and tight somewhere along the way, but we don't have many examples, and we don't use them. We don't use them. It's not an important feature in our environment. So if you grow up speaking Korean, this is an important part of your environment. If you grow up speaking English, it's not. So when you get to a learning task as a college student, the Korean students will use that. It's an important dimension for them. And the American students won't use it. As babies, they all use it. So the brain apparently is programmed, constructed, to take that aspect of the environment and use it. And having used it and perceived it, if the language calls attention to it, if you label it, if people use it with you, then that part of your brain becomes well established. But if they don't, and in America we don't, it becomes an unused part of your awareness, which is not there. Another example like that we'll talk about when we look at language, because our best understanding of grammar is that grammar is part of the operating system. As we're looking at our experience in the world, we're paying attention to particular features of it that we can then add words to, and we will learn grammatical rules for describing particular changes or differences in our experience in the world. And we learn those grammatical rules in our language from example without being taught. And it appears that the human mind has evolved so that it pays attention to particular characteristics of experience and is prepared to attach grammatical rules to them or understand the relationship of the grammatical rules. And most of those grammatical rules, unless you did really, really well in eighth grade English, you don't even know you know. You don't have labels for them. You can use them in your spoken language, but you don't know what you're doing. But it's based on the way your brain works. And they all work the same way. Yeah.
We're talking about a similar thing, linguistic relativity.
Yep.
And it's like the idea that language influences your worldview, how you perceive the world around you. And it was there a comparison between the American culture and we have words for time because they're count now. You can count like one day, one week, a month, summer. And then it compared it to, I think it was. They don't have words related to time. So if you wanted to say something about the summer, you wouldn't say that, like it could be like I was summering. Like time is a verb. But time isn't. They don't break up time into chunks like they do. Like
Right? They represent the world that they experience differently, and every language does that. Every language is a different way to represent the world that you experience, and the linguistic relativity principle is that the language that you are learning is calling your attention to particular aspects of the experience that you're having, and if it's not linguistically represented, it is considered unimportant. It doesn't mean you won't pay attention to it. It means you may not be able to represent it linguistically. That's a transaction, because languages tend to represent the characteristics or the aspects of experience that are important in the location where that language is spoken. So what you have is a brain, and we'll talk about this a little bit more next week. What you have is a brain that is experiencing, and it is trying to represent the important aspects of that experience. And it's representing that in part in language. It's not the only way we represent, but it is an important way that we represent our experience. Languages represent the experience. They are not the experience, but they can draw your attention to particular aspects of the experience. But the transactional other direction of that is that if something is important in your experience, you will probably make up a word for it. So if time is really important to you, you'll probably develop a vocabulary for it. If your language has a vocabulary for it, and you learn that language, you will attend to that aspect. Okay? We're going to explore that a bit. Let me explore a couple of other things. Having raised the issue of representation, what you have in your brain is not your experience. What you do with your brain is to represent your experience. I want you to think about that word, represent. It means to re-present. How do you present your experience? How do you re-present it? So, we're going to do a little exercise. I carried a long stick, and I try to speak carefully, but not softly. So I'd like you, in your notebook, to prepare to draw. So, here's your task. Here's a stick. And it's about to do something, and I want you to draw what it does. Okay? Just draw it. Want me to do it again? Okay, what you are doing when you draw is representing something graphically or in drawing. You're doing a graphic representation of it. So I need 6 volunteers to bring what they've done and draw it on the board. Quickly. 6 of you, stand up and draw what you drew, but draw it in chalk on the board. You each get 1/6 of the board. One, two, three, four. Hey, they're good. They're good. Okay, thank you. Good, aren't they good? All right, big hand for the volunteers. Okay, so we see immediately there is one way to represent, right? What do we have? Tell us what you did. Whose is this and what did you do? Okay, so here's the starting point, here's a midway point. Did you actually see that? Of course. Okay. And horizontal is the resting point at the end. Okay, same thing. What are these? It's traveling. Okay, we have lines representing the direction of travel, and we have three intermediate positions, all with the base relatively in the same place and the final state. Okay. But the lines are a convention that graphic artists use in our culture to represent motion. Yeah? And what you have is beginning point, end point, three intermediate positions, and the table. Yes, you saw a table. The table is important. Good. So you've represented the table. Another one, this one is round. Recognizing that this is a round dowel. This one is represented with a round surface on both ends. That's interesting that you can see both ends, or it's become transparent. But recognizing that you wanted to represent in some way that this is a cylinder, and again, beginning, end point, it suddenly got short and fat. You didn't have room. Okay, so you had to telescope in. Okay, and again, movement illustrated with lines. Aha! This one has the hand behind the phenomenon. Okay, that's me. Hole in the head. Table, professor, endpoint, the trajectory traveled, curved lines. Now those are curved too. Okay, but not the starting point. So you saw the fall and the endpoint, and it's still bouncing. Okay. Another table, another professor. He's lost weight. Movement, a midpoint, is that an accurate representation of my hand? No, not the six-figure drawing. Did I move my hand down there? Okay. So why are they all different? You saw the same thing, right? You all saw the same thing. You had the same experience. But in representing it, you use different rules, different vocabulary, different skills in graphic representation, and different conventions to represent the phenomenon. How many of them actually look like, really look like a video would look like if we'd seen the video? Okay. They are all sketches. They're all partial representations. And they're all wonderful and they all work. And we'll take that up on Monday.